The Path of Compassion by G. de Brucker.
Section 1. The Primeval Wisdom Teaching. Page 3, Chapter 1. Passing on the Light. There is but one occultism, one truth. The fountain of wisdom on this earth is the Brotherhood of Adepts, the spiritual heart of the world, from which streams unceasingly a flow of inspiration and enlightenment. It is the one supreme source from which have derived all the facets of truth that the religious and philosophical systems of the world contain. From there come forth not only the great sages and teachers from time to time, as the guides and instructors of men, but also envoys or messengers, whether known or unknown, who work in the world for the benefit of mankind. This fountain source of wisdom is formed of the noblest spiritual and intellectual giants that humanity has ever produced, men who have become at one with the God within. Knowing each other, they band together and thus form the great school of light and truth, the Great Brotherhood. Called by various names in different ages, the higher ones are known in Buddhist countries as Dhyani Chohans. The ancient Persians referred to the members of this solar hierarchy as Amshaspens. Jewish mystics and Kabbalists spoke of them as Bnei Elohim, sons of the gods, and in other countries they were called sons of light or sons of the sun, as in ancient Egypt. Innumerable schools of occultism, all derivative from the mother school, have existed in the past, exist presently, and will exist in the future. The mysteries of the Greeks were one such school, as were those of the Persians and the Egyptians. The mysteries practiced in the ancient Americas, such as among the Peruvians and the Mayas, were schools in the same sacred tradition. Both the Lamaism of Tibet and the Vedanta of Hindustan are essentially schools of occultism, although they are also systems of exoteric philosophy. The Rosicrucians of the medieval ages were originally a mystic, theosophic, and quasi-esoteric body, and the Martinists of France, existing even today, form one of the occultistic schools. Then there are the so-called alchemical bodies, whether in India, Asia Minor, or in Europe, whose adherents, while possessing a modicum of spiritual aspiration, nevertheless yearn even more for powers or phenomena. There are, moreover, in the Orient, a number of quasi-occult groups, some larger, some smaller, which study in their own way the different remnants of mystical literature which past ages have brought into being in those countries. In Persia, Egypt, Syria, and in parts of Turkey, similar bodies exist, often very exclusive, and usually nothing is heard of them. All such associations, in every country and every age, do a certain good work in their way in proportion to the amount of the ancient wisdom that they teach. But such truth as they do impart is too often seen through the distorting mental prisms of those who have wandered from the fountain source. Only as they pass on faithfully the splendor originally received from the mother school can they rightly be called schools of occultism. It may be added that there are in the world at the present time, in every one of the great continental masses, a very few, genuinely esoteric schools connected with the Brotherhood. A few intuitive scholars have suspected the existence of esoteric teachings in the archaic mystery schools, but these have never yet been found in a coherent body. In the different literatures of antiquity, we find an allusion here, a reference there, but a reasoned and explicit series of such teachings exists only in places to which no uninitiated student has hitherto consciously penetrated. In recording the deeper truths for later generations, the ancient sages and seers adopted the use of metaphor or figures of speech, often in fantastic and curious tales, legends, fairy stories, mythological romances. Plato, for instance, through the use of myth, gave out many guarded hints regarding matters taught in the mysteries. But because he himself knew what he was about and had received permission to do this, and did it under the cloak of metaphor, it was not a violation either of the letter or of the spirit of his oath. It is actually by so using esoteric terms that the great teachers of past ages wrote letters to each other and composed their books, passing them from hand to hand. Those who were initiated could understand what they read. To them it was intelligible and clear. But to the man who had not been received within the temple walls, the teachings were merely speculative philosophy, or perhaps meaningless jargon. These wisdom teachings have come down in direct succession from sage to sage, ever since the mysteries were first instituted among men in late Lemurian and Atlantean times, a step which became essential because mankind had lost the power of direct and conscious communion with their divine ancestors. Men were thus taught to raise the soul by an effort of the will combined with intense aspiration, so that they might be brought into direct intercourse, spiritually and intellectually, with their own inner God, or with some other divinity. It was in this way that the noblest truths about man and the universe were originally perceived, and thereafter sung, to use the word of the Veda, that is, formulated into human speech. Why is it that in practically all the ancient literatures, spiritual teaching was given in the vernacular of the battlefield? The Bhagavad Gita, for instance, tells of the conflict between the opposing armies of the Kurus and the Pandavas. In the Germanic and Scandinavian mythologies, there is the constant battling between the gods and the heroes. So also in the Greek, Egyptian, Persian, and Babylonian mythologies. All are alike in this respect. The question is easily answered. To little children we give storybooks. To those who cannot understand the meaning of peace and quiet and the enormous strength that lies in these, we talk of battle and of fighting, because there is always a victor and a vanquished. Thus in the literatures of the world, secrets of mystic truths were written in the epic vein, in order to meet the mental characteristics of those ages. But behind all this, there were the esoteric schools, which taught truth and compassion more directly, such as did Lao Tzu of China. Quote, "The way of Tao is not to strive." End quote. This is the contrary of quietism, for quietism is usually spiritual stupefaction, whereas the whole effort should be to embody in one's life and in every fiber of one's being an active spirit of compassion for all mankind. Footnote. Every system of religio-philosophical thought has had its own term for this universal esoteric doctrine. In the Hindu scriptures of the pre-Buddhist era, it is referred to as Brahmavidya, Atmavidya, and Guptavidya, meaning respectively knowledge of the Supreme, knowledge of self, and secret knowledge. Also as Rahasya, a word signifying mystery and bearing the same connotation as the Mysterion of the Greeks, and the gnosis of Neoplatonism and the Gnostic schools. In Buddhism, it was and still is known under such terms as Arya-jñāna, noble or exalted knowledge, and Bodhidharma, wisdom law or path. End footnote. Just as the original esoteric bodies became the great religious and philosophical schools of the past, just so the present theosophical movement was intended to be the spiritual intellectual nursery from which will be born the great philosophical and religious and scientific systems of future ages. Indeed, the heart of the civilizations of the coming cycles. In every important age, theosophical movements in various parts of the globe have been founded. A few succeeded. Most of them lived for a while, did some good, achieved a certain amount of the work that was to be done, and then failed, becoming a church, a sect, a dogmatic set of beliefs. Such periodic efforts to instill into men's hearts the ageless verities will continue throughout future time until human beings shall have so evolved that they will welcome light when it comes and will honor it as the most precious gift that they have. Thus it was that in 1875, two men of Buddha-like soul took upon their shoulders the challenge of making themselves karmically responsible, in a sense, for the sending out of a new message, which, by the force of its innate vigor and the persuasive power of its truths, would induce men to think. From then on, science began to have stirrings of new ideas. Fresh impulses were injected into the thought atmosphere of the world, and not least, the ideal of working toward an eventual universal brotherhood among all peoples took firm hold. The chief objective was to have these ancient spiritual principles work as a leaven in human thought, in the religious and philosophical strata, and ultimately in the social structure itself. H.P. Blavatsky was inspired to write her masterworks, Isis Unveiled and The Secret Doctrine, not for the purpose of founding another religion, but to restate once again, and in fuller measure, the archaic wisdom tradition of mankind in its more esoteric aspects. As such, she was one of the links in the serial line of teachers who come at certain stated periods for the passing on of esoteric light and truth. She came at the beginning of a new messianic cycle and the ending of an old one, and thus was the messenger for the age to come. This succession of teachers, the one following the other, has continued through countless centuries. There is nothing amazing about it. It is simply an illustration of one of nature's laws that just as generation succeeds generation, and one genus in evolutionary time comes after some other genus, so is there a chain of wise men continuing the flow of truth down the ages. In Sanskrit writings, this is called the Guru Parampara, of which there are two kinds. First, those sages who rise one above the other, as it were, in progressively greater wisdom and spiritual dignity, and second, those who follow each other in time and in one line of succession in the outer world of men. The same pattern was known to the Greek poets and philosophers, Homer and Hesiod both speaking of the golden chain connecting Olympus and Earth, and later Greek mystical writers referred to it as the Hermetic chain. This passing on of the torch of light from hand to hand has always been, and always will be, as long as the call comes from the hearts of men. When that call dies, the chain of succession remains intact, but the teachers no longer work openly. The guardians of mankind, name them as you will, masters, mahatmas, adepts, or elder brothers of the race, work wherever they see the slightest chance to do good, to cultivate the spiritual nature of their fellow human beings. Obviously, any society or group of people, or any individual, who tries to follow a noble pathway in life, will receive their help, if worthy of it. Worthiness is the test, the soul test. Whenever the right call is made, it will be answered. But any call, merely for self-benefit, most emphatically is not the right call. The only call they recognize is that given by those whose hearts yearn for light, and whose minds seek wisdom, and whose souls are swayed by compassion. And further, the call must be made solely in order to lay such wisdom and light as may be received on the altar of service to humanity. There is not a single earnest heartbeat that remains unanswered, not a single soul aspiration to help that is not faithfully registered. Thus is the Brotherhood of Adepts the guardian and custodian of the primeval wisdom, whose members are sworn to preserve it in secrecy and in silence until someone knocks at the portals with the right knock. They in turn receive light from others higher than they, and so on forever in this Theosophia, the wisdom of the gods, transmitted to men along the golden chain of Mercury, the interpreter.